Welcome to episode 17 of the Word Theater Podcast, your weekly access to the world's finest short stories. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner. This is the seventh and final week of our seven-episode celebration of Joyce Carol Oates stories, performed by brilliant actors and recorded live with the author in the room.
The four stories you will hear today are short gems that each express the anxieties of normal people trying to navigate the modern world. The first two were recorded in East Hampton, New York, and the last two were performed in Los Angeles, the first time we hosted Joyce at Word Theater.
Her writing has a kind of lyrical fluidity that is simply beautiful. I feel as though all the stories that we've selected lend themselves easily to being performed by actors, which makes total sense, as I've learned that Joyce also writes plays.
To introduce Party, a Pushcart Prize-winning story, we have an actor who has been performing at Word Theater in Los Angeles and New York since its inception. She is always the first person I ask to read the most technically challenging stories we undertake because she makes it sound easy. Please welcome Dana Delaney.
This story is like a runaway train. Three pages, one sentence. I remember the words tumbling one into the other and things quickly unraveling as we learn what's really happening. Joyce writes so that you can see and hear everything clearly. Everyone seems familiar, yet it's almost like a fever dream. And when you truly understand, it's gut-wrenching. I have often thought of the story since that wonderful pushcart benefit in East Hampton, New York, because disappointing as it may seem, it speaks to situations that are all too true.
Judith Lambert was dying at last. She had come home from the medical center for the fifth and final time in how many months? 18? Since her cancer was first diagnosed. But the Institute party was scheduled for that night, the handwritten invitation sent out weeks ago, so they were at the party. Judith's many friends and a number of her colleagues from the Bedminster Choir College, where Judith had taught voice for 15 years. How sad, they were saying. How tragic. She is such a young woman, 47, and looks 10 years younger, despite the chemotherapy. Gathered about the long candlelit table were plates of hors d'oeuvres, were set amidst coolly fragrant spring flowers, daffodils, jonquils, hyacinth, taking up Swedish meatballs on toothpicks, jumbo shrimp dipped in Mexicali hot sauce. Take care, the director's wife warns, that sauce is hot. How lovely everything looks tonight, and this wine, this is superb wine, German, is it? And how delicious the stuffed mushrooms. Did you make this yourself, Isabel? Judith Lambert's spring concert last year was a great success, everyone said, and I wasn't able to get to it because I myself had to be out of town. Oh, yes, you missed a lovely concert. Judith sang songs by Schubert, Fauré, I think, miniatures, most of them. Such a fine, clear, beautiful voice she had. Something plaintive about it, but not a strong voice, of course, not powerful. Once I heard her sing that Mozart aria, Bella Mia Fiamma, and you could tell she'd reached her limit. But she had a haunting voice. It's all such a pity. Judith's daughter was saying, Mother, please, Mother. Are you awake, Mother? The bedroom was papered in a floral design, fine patterned, French silk, lavender, soft green, ivory, matching bedspread and a thick ivory carpet. Ginny Mullen had visited her the week before. It is so sad, she said, tears welling in her eyes. Yes, yes, she's changed a great deal now. She looks so frail, so thin. Thank God her daughter's with her. And thank God for morphine. A new couple had just entered the hall, shaking hands with the Institute director, Dr. Max, and his wife, Isabel. Tall, flaxen-haired, sharp-eyed Isabel. If you decline one of her invitations, she will never invite you back. That dinner party Judith gave at Christmas, there must have been 20 of us, and she tried to do it all herself, not even a student to help in the kitchen. Of course, it was a buffet and not so much trouble, but still. And do you know, I never got around to inviting her back. This season has been sheer madness. We're in Minneapolis, and we're in Atlanta, and where else? Los Angeles, of course. I am reminded of a line from a play, or is it a poem? Shall I ever have time to die? The heroine asks. Her doctor said she'd have a year to live with the treatments. I think that was terribly blunt and cruel, don't you? And wrong, by about 6 months, too. She's been taking chemotherapy off and on all this time, and the wonder of it is, her hair, her lovely hair, didn't fall out. Can you imagine Judith without that lovely hair? That lovely red hair. So brave. Such a model of courage, endurance, such a vital attitude towards the future. This cheese is exquisite. Is it some kind of Italian cheese? This is goat cheese. Oh, Mark, you must try it. Her attitude was so positive, it was daunting sometimes, the way she spoke of the future. Plans for next year's concert series at Bedminster and the year after. Mark says it was a necessary blindness, a kind of denial. Where did you get this pâté, Isabel? It's duck, isn't it? Oh, that little store on Charity Street off South Street. You know the one I mean? Oh, yes, I've seen it, but I haven't gone inside. I feel so bad about Judith. That lovely party she gave, and I never invited her back. It's so awkward with a single woman at a sit-down dinner, don't you think? Did I tell you? Mark is flying to Johannesburg on Monday, some sort of confidential government business. I'm concerned there'll be a civil war while he's there, and he won't be able to get out. Judith looks so lovely at the Christmas concert, directing the woman's choir. That white dress she wore that looked like an antique dress, full-skirted, flounced, with ruffles at her throat, long sleeves, lacy cuffs. I think it was to disguise the fact that she lost so much weight. Oh, just the Messiah, I think, the usual. Oh, yes, it was a shame about Rod leaving her, but it seems to have worked out for the best. Judith was the happiest I've ever seen her after the divorce came through. Oh, there's no bitterness between them that anyone ever noticed, though. There must have been some emotion involved. You can't be married for 20 years without some emotion involved, yes, but the daughter's all grown up. All our children are all grown up. Have you noticed? It has happened so quickly. All our children are grown up, and most of them are moved away. A faint sickle moon was shining through the tall leaded windows of the Institute's main hall, where 100 guests were gathered and a string quartet played in a corner on a raised platform edged with flowers. In the din of voices, no one could hear the music, but the musicians, good sports from the Bedminster School, played briskly on. Something by Beethoven, it sounded like. Is that the moon? Where? In the trees. There. The moon? No, I don't think so. It looks like one of the lights in the parking lot. Mother, said Judith's daughter, can you hear me? Are you awake? Mother, I love you, Judith's daughter said, but it wasn't clear that Judith heard. The skin around her eyes looked stitched. Bruised pouches beneath the eyes. It must be the mask of death, since Judith is dying. But her daughter stands transfixed, unable to judge. I remember Rosalind Lambert when she was a little girl passing plates of hors d'oeuvres at one of our parties, a lawn party it was. Rod and Judith certainly gave the impression of being happily married then. Such an attractive couple. Judith looked like one of those pre-Raphaelite women, you know the ones I mean? Didn't that artist, the one who lived in the Hawley's coach house, paint her? And what became of that painting, I wonder? His new wife is very sweet, they say, though I've never met her. One of his graduate students, evidently. Doesn't time pass swiftly now, and incessantly? They were talking of the new woman's choir director, the blonde young woman from Juilliard, whose husband is assistant dean at the seminary. An attractive young couple, but there's so many attractive young couples these days. Thank you so much, Isabel, for inviting us. Thank you for coming, but isn't it a little early to be leaving? I called Judith last week, but Rosalind said she was sleeping, couldn't be disturbed. She spoke rather sharply to me, I thought. I was a little bit hurt. After all, I've been a friend of Judith's for so long. It was one of the first people Judith told. Max said he bought a case of this by way of that dealer in Pensfield, Bernkostler Dr. Auslies, 1982. Not what you call cheap, but it was a bargain. The funeral will be next week, probably, and the memorial service has to be planned, but not until May, I suppose. Did you go to Dr. Emery's memorial? It was fairly well attended, but I was surprised at the people missing you'd have expected to see there. He was so well loved, just students adored him. Oh, well, that's usually the case this time of year. It's madness this time of year. I'm committed to a conference in Geneva next week I wish I could get out of. A week-long session in Tokyo next month. Loans and financing for the third world, more of the same thing. The situation is hopeless and getting worse, but don't quote me. Is Judith's daughter with her? No? I thought someone said she was. She is? Oh, I'd heard they'd hired a private nurse. I guess she'd have to in cases like this. Dying at home. Poor Judith, but at least she's in comfortable surroundings. And where is Rod? He wouldn't dare miss the funeral, but he hasn't visited her in a year. He's very big, they say, at La Jolla. Found his niche at last. Did Florence tell you they're having a reception for the French ambassador next week? I hope there's not going to be an awkward conflict with the funeral. Judith closed her skeletal fingers around her daughter's wrist and seemed about to smile as she so frequently did, though her eyes flashed with panic. But this time she didn't smile. She whispered, "Help me." And her daughter said, "I'm right here, Mother. I'm not going to go away." A faint moon through the window in the trees beyond the house, hazy like the lamplight in the room, the only light burning, filtered through the fluted, flesh-colored shade. "Our new astrophysicist is being wooed by the California Institute of Technology already. Did you hear? It's outrageous. Everyone bids on the stars and no one wants the others. I won't be out of town for the party. This time of year is such madness. Are those dogwood sprays? Apple blossoms? So lovely. Shall I ever have time to die?" she wondered. She was staring into a corner of the room where friends with the looks of strangers were talking and laughing loudly. Someday. Yes. Judith's daughter dialed the number she knew by heart and said into the receiver, calm as words said many times, "I think she has died." "Yes, a few minutes ago." "The funeral will be this week. The memorial service in early May. We'll have to get together with those boring Bedminster people to plan it." At the door, Ginny Mullins squeezed my hand and whispered in my ear, "The invitations should be in the mail by next Friday, but remember, keep the night of May 11 open. For us."
Our next story is also a Pushcart Prize winner. It is performed by an actor that I loved for her work on television, but it was when I saw her on stage that I knew she would be great for word theater. She graced the Guildhall stage for another of our Pushcart benefits in East Hampton and will now introduce The Undesirable Table. Please welcome Polly Draper.
Joyce Carol Oates uses satire and humor effortlessly in this story. She seems fearless and knows how to get under the skin of her characters. It is truly uncanny the way this writer can reveal our human frailties while her language delights in pretentious romps of desire. I am not surprised this story was awarded a Pushcart Prize. Enjoy.
With mumbled apologies, the maitre d' seated us at an undesirable table in our favorite restaurant, Le Coq d'Or. The men in our party protested, but there was nothing to be done. It was a Saturday night in the holiday season. The more desirable tables had been booked weeks in advance. Our reservation had been made practically at the last minute. What could we expect? Even though we are frequent patrons of Le Coq d'Or and had imagined ourselves on special terms with the management. As we took our seats, reluctantly, at the undesirable table in a front bay window of the dining room, one of our party remarked, bemused yet serious, that perhaps the maitre d' had expected a $20 bill to be slipped surreptitiously to him. Was that it? Seated at the undesirable table in a front bay window of the dining room of Le Coq d'Or, we discussed this possibility in lowered, incensed voices. We are highly verbal people, and much of dispute in our lives is resolved, if not satisfied, by speech. The more cynical among our party believed that, yes, this might be so. Though, in the past, and we dined in this restaurant innumerable times, the maitre d' had not behaved like an extortionist. The more optimistic among our party believed that, no, that wasn't it. At all. Surely not. Our reservation had been made late, just the day before. The holiday season was frenzied this year. It was Saturday night. And so why not enjoy ourselves, as we'd come to do? Even if it was something of a disappointment, and a rude surprise, actually, in a way, to be seated at an undesirable table at Le Coq d'Or. And so, seated at the undesirable table in the front bay window of the dining room of Le Coq d'Or, with an unwanted view of the street outside, we gave our drink orders to the waiter, we smiled gamely, and took up our hefty Le Coq d'Or menus, parchment-bound, gilt-printed, gold-tasseled, with elegantly scripted French and English translations below, and perused the familiar categories of appetizers, first courses, entrees, desserts, wines. We chattered to one another, discussing the dishes we might order, recalling previous meals at Le Coq d'Or, previous evenings in one another's company that had been both intellectually stimulating and emotionally rewarding, evenings that had had meaning of a kind, precious to consider. For food consumed in the presence of dear friends is not mere food, but sustenance, a sustenance of the soul. A formal meal with excellent wines in a restaurant of the quality of Le Coq d'Or in the right company is a celebration. Yes? So it was. We smiled gamely. We chattered happily. We were not to be cheated of our evening's pleasure. For most of us, a well-deserved reward from the rigors of the previous week by the accident of being seated at an undesirable table. We gave our orders to the waiter, who was all courtesy and attentiveness. We handed back our hefty menus. When our drinks arrived, we lifted them to drink with pleasure and relief. We were almost successfully ignoring two facts. One, that the undesirable table in the bay window of the dining room was even more undesirable than most pessimistic of us had anticipated. And that those of us unfortunate enough to be seated facing the bay window were particularly afflicted. Yet, such was our courtesy to one another, even after years of friendship, and so awkward was the situation, that no one, not even those facing the bay window in the street, chose to speak of it. For to name a problem is to invest it with too much significance. We, who are so highly verbal, whose lives, it might be said, are ingeniously amassed cities of words, understand the danger as few others do. Ah, yes. There followed then, with much animation, a discussion of wines, in which several of our company, male, participated with great gusto and expertise, while others listened with varying degrees of attentiveness and indulgence. Which wines of the many wines of Le Coq d'Or's excellent list were to be ordered? Considering that the party was to dine variously on seafood, fish, poultry, and meat. Our conversations about wine are always lengthy and passionate, and touched with a heartfelt urgency, even pedantry. Yet there is an undercurrent of bemused self-consciousness, too, for the wine connoisseurs are well aware of the absurdity of their almost mystical fanaticism, even as they unapologetically indulge in it. After all, if there is a simple, direct, unalloyed ecstasy to be taken by the mouth, savored by the tongue like a liquid communion wafer, how can it be denied to those with the means to purchase it? And by whom? So, the usual spirited talk of wine among our party, and some argument. Where there is passion, there is argument. Not that the wine connoisseurs dominated completely, despite their loud voices. Conversation became more general. There were parenthetical asides, the usual warm queries of health, recent trips, family, work, gossip of mutual acquaintances, colleagues. If there was a distracting scene outside the window on the street, which in fact was an avenue, broad, windy, littered, eerily lit by street lamps whose light seemed to withhold, not give, illumination, or even on the sidewalk a few yards away from those of our company with our backs stolidly to the window, we knew nothing of it. We saw nothing. At last, our appetizers were brought to us, and the first of the wines, their ceremonial uncorking. Exquisite! Red caviar, arugula salads, giant shrimp delicately marinated, pâté maison, escargot, coquille Saint-Jacques, consommé à la barigoue, steak tartare, and of course, the thick, crusty brown bread that is a specialty of Le Côte d'Or. As we talked now of politics, foreign, national, state, local, we talked of religion. Is there any demonstrable difference between the actions of believers and non-believers? We asked after our friends' children in the hope and expectation that they would ask after ours. One of our party, her gaze drawn repeatedly to something outside the window, which, facing it as she was at this undesirable table in the dining room of Le Côte d'Or, seemed to possess a morbid attraction for her, suddenly laid her fork down, closed her eyes, as conversation swirled about her. But she said nothing, and nothing was said to her, and after a pause of some seconds, she opened her eyes, and gazing now resolutely at her plate, she picked up her fork and resumed eating. Another of our party weakened, laid his fork down too, pressed the back of his hand against his forehead. Again, conversation continued, our eyes firmly fixed on one another, and after a minute or so, he too revived, with steely resolution, lifting his wine glass to his mouth and draining it in a single swallow. Bif stroganoff, pompano à la meunière, bouillabaisse, sweetbreads à la York, Chateaubriand, blanquette of veal, coq au vin, and sole lyonnaise, and an elegantly grilled terrapin with black mushrooms, and julienne vegetables lightly sautéed in olive oil. Another generous basket of crusty brown bread, and another bottle of wine, this time a Bordeaux. One of our party, a woman with widened, moist eyes, said, "Huh? What are they doing?" Staring out the window in an attitude of disbelieving horror, but adding quickly, a hot blush mottling her face, "No, really, don't look." No one of us having looked or even heard, in any case. Yes. Certainly, it crossed the minds of those gentlemen of our party with their backs to the offending scene to offer to exchange seats with the women facing it. Yet, we hesitated, and finally, as if by mutual consent, said nothing. For to name a problem, in particular an upsetting and demoralizing problem over which none of us has any control, is to invest it with too much significance. How popular Le Côte d'Or is. A region, an atmosphere, an exquisite state of soul rather than merely a restaurant. In such surroundings, amid the glitter of flashing cutlery, expensive glassware, and crystal chandeliers,
animal gluttony is so tamed as to appear a kind of asceticism. At Le Coq d'Or, a perfectly orchestrated meal, which we were determined ours would be, even at an undesirable table, is rarely a matter of less than 2 hours. Casting our eyes resolutely not in the direction of the window, the avenue, the luckless creatures outside, but rather with some envy at the parties seated at desirable tables. Impossible not to feel resentment, bitterness, rancor, even as we smiled and smiled, even as the maitre d' hovered guiltily near, inquiring after the quality of our food and drink and service, which we assured him with impeccable politeness and a measure of coolness, was excellent as always. Yet, why are these other patrons favored with desirable tables while we, equally deserving, perhaps more so, are not? Perennial questions of philosophy, the mystery of good, evil, God, devil, more wine, a final bottle uncorked, through the plate glass bay window, an occasional unwelcome, unheard stridency of sound, keening wails or sirens. No. Mere vibration. All sound is vibrations, devoid of meaning. Coffee, liqueurs, desserts so delicious they must be shared. Sorbet à la Bruxelles, profiteroles au chocolat, meringue glacée, zablione frappé, strawberries flambées, and those luscious Swiss mints. It was observed that the rose-tinted wax candles at the center of the table had burned low. Their flames had begun to flicker. A romance of candlelight. The circular table, draped in a fine oyster-white linen cloth, the rose-patterned cushioned chairs were floating in a pool of darkness, staring intensely at one another. Friends, dear friends, the fever of our love for one another, our desperate faith in one another, transfixed by one another's faces, for there lies meaning. Yes? You expected me to weaken, to surrender to an instinctive narrative momentum in which the not named is suddenly and therefore irrevocably named. Following the conventions of narration, I might have proceeded then to events B, C, D, the horror of disclosure increasing in rhythm with the courses of our elaborate meal. By the climax, the emptying of the very last bottle of wine, the paying of the check, our rising to leave, a revelation would have occurred. We would never be the same again after our experience at the undesirable table. But that was not my way, because it did not happen that way. There was no naming, thus there was no narrative. The check was paid, we rose to leave. One of us, fumbling for her handbag, dropped it. It fell to the chair, from the chair to the floor, spilling some of its contents with a startled little cry. We walked through the dining room of Le Coq d'Or without a backward glance at the undesirable table. Let the maitre d', who wished us happy holidays with a forced smile, worry that we'll never return to his damn restaurant. Let him worry that he insulted us, and we'll spread the word to others. Our revenge. Fortunately, there is a high-rise parking structure directly accessible from Le Coq d'Or, so that patrons are spared walking along the windswept, littered avenue and the possible danger of this walk. We'd parked our cars there, on level A, and the cooler air, we felt a sudden giddy sense of release, like children freed from confinement. We were talking loudly, we were laughing, we shook hands warmly, saying good night. We hugged one another. We kissed old friends, dear friends. Now that the ordeal of the undesirable table was behind us, it was possible to forget it. In fact, we were rapidly forgetting it. We would retain instead the far more meaningful memory of another superb meal shared at Le Coq d'Or, another memorable evening in one another's company. Of course we'll be back. many times. For Le Coq d'Or is quite simply the finest restaurant available to us. It might be said we have no choice.
We found our next reader just as he was graduating from acting school in London, Lambda, and we are so proud to have kept him reading at Word Theatre as he has continued his upward career trajectory, moving from one great film and television project to another. To introduce Angry, please welcome Gethin Anthony.
You are about to hear two pages by Joyce Carol Oates that accelerate from zero to blast off in a matter of minutes. This is a cautionary tale. It is quite startling the way the writing is able to illuminate dark, triggering behaviour on multiple levels. I found it a fascinating little piece to perform. I felt like I had lived for years, not minutes, from the moment I began reading to the moment I stopped. Here is Angry by Joyce Carol Oates.
The first time he saw E, she was angry. Speaking quietly but passionately with a man, a stranger to him, though of about his age and height. And it was summer and warm and windy off the lake, and E wore a white cotton dress cut to show her bare shoulders, her lovely tanned arms and shoulders, and there was her dark hair like a hazy cloud about her head and the tears shining in her eyes. And in this quarrel, she held herself composed, even dignified, and he was thinking, how beautiful. The bright chiaroscuro of the woman's dark tanned skin and the glaring white of her dress. How beautiful. Never had any woman spoken in such a way to him, in public or in private, nor had he ever known a woman of such eerie composure in the height of an emotion. The memory of her remained with him for days, as vivid as any dream, and he found he was looking for her everywhere. And then, as such things happen when he'd virtually given up, there she was. So unexpectedly. In the IGA store, where on Friday evenings, back late from New York City, he shopped swiftly and pragmatically for the weekend. There, suddenly she was ahead of him in the checkout line, in a summer knit sweater, a plain skirt, sandals. And this time, too, she was angry. Both amused and angry. Since the cashier had struck not one wrong key, but two wrong keys, so E was insisting upon a complete recounting of all her purchases, which seemed to him only reasonable. He'd murmured, "Good for you." But so quietly she didn't seem to hear. He had made up his mind then to meet her, to know her, since he was already in love with her. And the first time they were together, meeting at the home of mutual friends the following weekend, he told her some of this, not all, but some. And he regarded him with mildly quizzical eyes, and he had a glimpse of himself through those eyes. The romance of his words, the oddness of them, and he laughed, liking it, himself and her. Then they were lovers, finally. Finally in love, or near love. Then one would advance a little too precipitously, and the other would instinctively withdraw, and when the first one, relenting, would return, the other would have soberly reconsidered, and this was love. And yet he looked at E, who was no less beautiful than she had ever been, and he was disappointed. Not resentful, but disappointed, for something was missing. What? E was an emotional woman, but it was primarily happiness he saw in her, ease, laughter, occasional exasperation, but she was tactful in ways no other lover had known to be tactful. Above all, E avoided quarrelling with him. No, never mind, she would say, and he would say, what? What is it? And she would shake her head, not answering, and he would persist. What were you going to say? Please. Until finally, after perhaps a year, they were living together now. They'd been talking of marrying. E did speak to him sharply, and he saw that look in her face, and his heart
pulsed as if she'd reached into him and touched it with her very fingers, and not in love. So suddenly they were talking, quietly, yet in anger. And then they were quarrelling, not so quietly, in anger. Yes, it was a true quarrel, such as he'd never had. Not quite like this. E's eyes were bright with tears, the pupils dilated, her nostrils dead white. She began to scream at him, at the persistence of him, his low-level, goading voice, his puzzlement, his hurt. She screamed and accused him of, and he called her, he of all men, he. Normally so soft-spoken and guarded, and unthinking as a child, she slapped him in the face. She was sobbing, the flat of her hand and the very centre of his undefended face, his nose, his glasses that went flying. And not knowing what he did, he grabbed the woman's shoulder and closed his fist, he of all men, striking the woman a blow thrown with his fullest strength, a strength he hadn't known he'd possessed. Yes, in that instant, he meant to smash her face that was so beautiful. He felt the cartilage of the beautiful no shatter, though afterwards begging her to forgive him, to marry him. He would say he was sorry, sorry, sorry. God, how sorry!
To introduce our last story, we have a phenomenal actor who read at one of the very first Word Theater events in Los Angeles. We feel truly honored that he loves participating in our events because each of his performances has been such a gift. Please welcome Philip Baker Hall, who will perform Pain by Joyce Carol Oates.
Now this author dives deep into the river of life. She's able to get down to the cellular level of what her characters are going through. Now, this story is just 3 pages. But the journey she takes you on, it is uncomfortable, but it's authentic. And it's true. And it's amazing. So, take a deep breath, because here we go.
When you are in pain, the pain is in you, for the pain is you. When you are in pain, the pain is in you, for the pain fits fully, like a hand thrust into a pliant glove. When you're in pain, the pain is you. And no one remains. When you are in pain, you cannot be apprehensive of the future or regretful of the past, for the pain is all present tense. And the pain is you when you are in pain. When you are in pain, the pain is you, and you have no need to name the pain or consider its causes. Nor do you need to speak of future humiliations or hopes of happiness, for the pain is you, and you are utterly absorbed. When you're in pain, you may be childish in weeping or stoic in character, but you need not fear injury, malaise, long, humid August days that ravel out to nothing, the despoiling of your name. When you're in pain, you cannot be snubbed or unfairly judged, since there is no one except the pain when you're in pain, and the pain is you. When you're not in immediate pain, your body is alert and tense as a network of wires strung tight, awaiting the return of pain. For the pain will return. For the pain is you. Such questions as, will it flash, sting, pulse, pry, stab, hammer, throb, ripple, pierce, flood? Inevitable questions when you are not in pain. For you must anticipate pain for it has proven itself worthy. When you are not in pain, you are obliged to inhabit certain human postures, as pride, courage, calm, lucidity, Olympian detachment, patience, resiliency, great sense of humor, sweetness, charm, dignity, noblesse oblige, innate good sense, common sense, rationality, optimism, and the rest. When you're not in pain. When you are not in pain, you may be brave or cowardly, as you wish. For the pain awaits its terrible return and passes no judgment. When you are not in pain, you may wallow in self-pity, as they say. Or you may deny, as they say, by absorbing yourself in other subjects. For pain offers no opinion, presents no bias. When you are not in pain, you may hide your ghastly, ravaged face behind your hands, or beg that all mirrors be taken from your sight, or would you wish all mirrors everywhere smashed? You may whisper gentle, reasonable requests that issue forth as screams. You may scream until your vocal cords are raw, but issue no sound. You may ring the tiny golden bells at your bedside shyly or furiously, as you wish. You may write desperate little notes to those whom you once loved and betrayed and forgot. You may contemplate, as they say, suicide. You may press your fevered face against the windowpane, and when no one sees, you may despoil the exquisite frost filigrees with your vile, scum-coated tongue, for the pain is merely absent and awaits its return. When you are in pain, the pain is in you, and the space you inhabit, which is the room or the world, or all you recall of either. When you're in pain, you have nothing to fear of vanity or sin, or over-subtlety, or hyperesthesia, or hypocrisy. When you are in pain, and the pain is in you, you are without language, and no one can pursue you into that country. You are the pain, and no one remains, and even the curvature of the earth, and the slow, dreamlike floating fall of the moon through the sky, and the myriad constellations of the great sky have disappeared. When you are in pain, the mirror's lead backing is dissolved, so, for once, you must gaze into nothing. When you are in pain and the pain is in you, a sudden sweetness floods your veins, which is piercing sunshine on frost, or dizzying arabesques in that wallpaper beside your head. When you are in pain, and the pain is in you, and the pain is you, you can no more resist than a diver can resist gravity once he is falling through the air. For there is no one to resist when you are in pain, and the pain is in you, and the pain is you. When the pain is.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to these four gems by Joyce Carol Oates. Next week, we will bring you ZZ Packer's story, Brownies, performed by Alfre Woodard.
If you're enjoying the Word Theatre podcast, you'll really enjoy our live streams. Each month, we have phenomenal authors and actors participating from all over the world. You can book a single ticket, but we hope you'll become an annual Word Theatre member because you'll be supporting our work and all the live streams are included free. So join our club and tell your friends. We're a non-profit and we're relying on you to spread the word.
A very special thanks to Joyce Carol Oates and her entire team for their support of Word Theatre. This wraps up our 7-episode celebration of Joyce Carol Oates' marvelous stories. We'd also like to give a big shout out to the Pushcart Prize because we have found so many of our favorite stories written by writers who have become our favorite participants in the pages of these 46 magnificent volumes. Thank you too to Jonathan Sachs for composing our theme music and to Joseph Cho, our technical director. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
And I'm Kirsty Pitt in England. Until next week, signing off.